Welcome to the Brilliant Podcast. This is the first in our series here in season three, where we're trying to introduce an anarchism that's contemporary anarchism in 2018, rather than sort of positioning a reactionary anarchism or an anarchism of anti. Really, what we're going to try to do is talk through the consequences of having, we'll call it a proactive or like an assertive position. And we're going to start this whole series with a conversation with my friend Dominique. Dominique and I have been collaborators for a number of years, and the concern for this episode and for our conversation today is we're going to talk specifically about the concept and the consequences of what we'll call an indigenous anarchism, but I think you have actually a different word that you like that's maybe more like a liminal anarchism. Welcome, Dominique.
Hello. I'm ready for some action.
Excellent. So why don't you talk a little bit about your introduction to anarchism and what you thought it was before you got to meet it or before you interacted with big town anarchism?
Right. So I was really introduced to anarchism in a distinct sense through prison, from getting free to prisoner publications. And at the time, I just was using reading as an escape or to have something outside of a lot of the day-to-day
boredom
and just, you know, conversations with people in prison. Well, like really a lot of what you're doing is watching TV for 18 hours a day.
Yeah, fuck that.
So I was looking for, so I guess I was involved in punk before. So as some kind of, it was on my radar that there was something called radical politics or anarchy. So I was just writing letters to get free publications from anything. And I think I didn't really know what the terrain was at all.
Sure.
So I'm just like, hi, I'm a native prisoner in South Dakota. Send me free literature that's about, and I think I was like, send me stuff about feminism, environmentalism, anarchy, communism, something like that. And I would kind of send a form letter. So I think it's funny to me now because I'm reading like Red Femme stuff in a super macho environment. So I guess me personally, I'm kind of, I like to be the outsider. So that's not a normal thing. But I feel like green anarchy and honestly some of Zerzan stuff, I'm just like, this is punk. This is spiky, fucked up fonts. And also I think green anarchy,
The magazine,
it talked about native issues, and that was something that a lot of other radical publications weren't touching on that, so it caught my attention.
Was there any content from there that you actually remember and that liking or having any opinions about it at all?
I guess it seemed like it, from the other things I was reading, this is also when I'm first coming in touch with like the situationist reading Society of the Spectacle with no,
no context.
Like
at all.
It was pretty incomprehensible. But it seemed like the Green Anarchy magazine had a bigger critique of what the problem was, that it wasn't just Communist Manifesto, worker, ruler, that it was like a lot of possible things that we have his assumptions might be part of the problem.
When you left prison, how long were you sort of trapped in the state because of parole or probation?
Not very long, really. I mean, I learned from a lot of people around me of how not to do it, which usually means you get stuck in failing parole, coming back, getting more charges. And I basically just got out and got a job and paid my fines off. And when I didn't owe them money, then they're like, okay,
you're done.
Get out of here, oh, that's basically.
Great. And so then did you immediately move out of state, or did you hang around for a little while?
Pretty soon after that, I left.
And you left to travel or to actually move to the Bay?
No, I was traveling, and this is one of the places I came through and tried some other places in the Northwest and was like, actually, I want to be in the Bay Area.
Did I meet you in that first circuit?
It's possible, definitely. I came to the study group.
Mm-hmm. So to your understanding today, to speak in hindsight and I guess in foresight, how would you describe anarchism through the lens of being a native person and through the lens of indigeneity, and maybe draw a distinction between the two?
Can you say more about what you mean by a distinction between those two?
Well, I think the distinction, to my view, is that, you know, native is how you're born, and indigenous is more.
Right. Okay, sure. So a lot of these experiences aren't from reading or, you know, from stories from relatives or anything like that. It's from interacting with radicals in the Bay Area. Mm. So I would just see like things like tokenizing. Generally, if you're in the anarchist space, there's going to be like a few minorities and a lot of people that are default categories, and that there's some kind of way that you can have power doing that. And it would seem strange sometimes to hear people having an indigenous point of view, such as just maybe we're on Ohlone land, but you would just get some native person that's from somewhere far away in a different context.
Sure.
Speaking from an indigenous point of view, and I guess, so just to talk about indigenous versus indigeneity, there are people that are enrolled in tribes. That's like the official standard.
Yes, indeed.
That you have a piece of paper from, in the U.S. anyways, from the federal government.
You're a good racehorse. You can run.
You can run. You have a pedigree. But that's also interesting, is that you just having that paper doesn't mean that you're tied to a culture.
Or a land base.
Or a land base. And the California tribes generally didn't participate in that narrative.
Although there are some, like in Northern California.
Sure. But, and then there's the whole thing about people from south of the border that have indigenous identities, which I could talk about also. But I think it's important that there's also people that are native culturally that don't have the piece of paper. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's why I'm talking about encounters with indigenous radicals here that are really invested in white privilege ideology, but that I know people from the res that are white as hell, but like grew up there, take part, are accepted. And that's maybe a part of indigeneity, is that you could, be from a different tribe and still be Anishinaabe, or you could be white and be part of it. And you could also be fully enrolled And not.
Right.
Yeah.
But really, I guess in this context, you know, what we want to talk about are like, why is being native a natural fit to anarchism? Because obviously in both of our experiences, most natives we've met who are interested in politics at all, at best are involved in some type of reformist politics where they're trying to fight for scraps from the state. But, you know, to my eyes, and I assume to yours, it seems like native values, it would make much more sense to sort of have some anarchistic values along the lines of being opposed to the sort of colonial apparatus that's been attached to this land since the arrival of those little boats.
So one part is that you could just say that all these tribes in the U.S. didn't have the same trajectory as Western states, that there was not a monotheistic worldview. There wasn't a nation state. So it's sort of by classical anarchist definitions, the people here didn't have that stuff. And you could get more into maybe they did, or maybe those aren't even the right questions to ask.
Yeah. I mean, this is an interesting direction to go in the conversation, because a lot of people hearing this will immediately want to parse out the particular types of conflicts that they've heard that different tribes have had with each other. And, you know, for me, I often talk about war in the context of this conversation. And a lot of people are like, well, sure, they might not have had mechanical slaughtering millions of people war, but what they did was pretty bad too. And so how do you escape getting bogged down in sort of definitional argumentation when you go here?
I'm not really interested in arguing with those people generally, but I think of things more, I guess, from a historical point of view that is not paternalistic, to mean that at least the tribes that we're from, when you're talking about like the French and Indian War and these kind of conflicts, it was not like a loincloth Indian gathering acorns. You're talking about fairly complex societies that are engaged in diplomacy and are very important military in a fully modern sense at that point in time.
Sure.
So I like to always leave open the possibility that you don't have to be nationalistic even about a tribe, that you don't have to defend that. We're kind of in a lot of these conversations, we need a time machine, something like that, where we can be like, how would I act pre-colonial in these important moments? And really, people were totally sophisticated, and I'd like to think that I probably would not be an Ojibwe nationalist even at that point.
Sure.
But as far as positive points of why you would connect anarchy with with different indigenous people is more of the idea that there were all of these different ways to interact with the world. And that's what I like more than that. Maybe people like to put Indians into a pet cause of leftism and to say that women, queers, all these different oppressed people have something in common. It's more that, to me, seems like you're trying to totalize who people are with a much bigger scope than I'm comfortable with. But the idea that there were a bunch of small groups that had different ideas and different ways of doing things, that's the kind of anarchy that I get more excited about.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's interesting, you know, just to put bluntly, like, my motivation for not just this conversation, but for this approach, I have a pretty big problem with the fact that most anarchist orientations continue to center struggles in France, Italy, Greece, and in Europe in general. And it's not just that they center those struggles, the thinking behind those struggles continues to resonate in the anarchist space here in the U.S. I mean, in my opinion, the crassest example of this is Antifa does not feel like an American reaction to the kind of right-wing, the right-wing movements that exist, but instead is a German import to the U.S., you know, with embarrassing affects like dressing like soccer hooligans and people, you know, literally wearing Antifa scarves and you know, a certain sort of parodying of a culture that is not, it's not the culture of this place. And, you know, for me, one of the reasons why I think anarchism remains such a marginal
perspective, you know, and I think it's more marginal now than it was a few years ago, is because of the way in which it feels like a foreign creature, like you know, an obsession by nerds who really like nerdly pursuits. And I'm not exactly sure that you know, that everybody parroting Ohlone people or wearing headdresses to music concerts is the solution to that. But it does seem like the examination from a source that originates here feels like a more productive direction than a source that originates in Europe already.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that about Antifa, about romanticizing these movements. And even, I guess you could say that that's where Black Bloc comes from.
Absolutely. Also German.
I guess I'm concerned with this kind of othering thing where you think that someone doing things somewhere else is more exciting than the mundane that we experience here. And I could see that happening with just being like, native people are outside of this. You're looking for something that's outside of what is boring, and that's easy to do. It's Rojava. The Zapatistas are closer.
Yeah, actually, I want to talk about them as a separate phenomenon here in a few minutes. But I had a conversation as another part of this series where the person who I was talking to was really fascinated and interested in quote-unquote communities of color and in the concept of community self-defense. But by and large, every definition of a community in a community that's interested in self-defense by this person's own expression are basically poor people who are stuck living together. And the reason why they're a community is because they're stuck living in proximity to each other, or perhaps, you know, because they share the same ethnicity rather than, well, and so in contrast, they're sort of referring to the work that they've done that, of course, has primarily been with white people. And that work has looked like building co-ops and building small businesses. And, you know, to me, it's really hard to escape the fact that white people do have a culture, and they don't like to call it culture. But that idea that, you know, if we start a business together and are able to fundraise via that business, that's a culture. That's a set of cultural values. That's a way of thinking about the world that's perhaps mercantile and perhaps embeds capitalism more than people are comfortable with. But like, there it is.
Sure. So maybe another point of defense of an indigenous worldview is that white culture is everywhere and is invisible. But also that you could start where you are. And you don't need to go to a pipeline protest, or you don't need to find the downtrodden. And I feel like this isn't really like a new contribution to anarchy. And that's what is still inspiring about the Situationist, that is an antidote to a lot of sort of activism that looks for the person that's most left out, and that maybe we can help them out, and that the we is really coded as people that are healthy and have something to offer people. But right. Really, my point is that we're all getting fucked over, and anyone can have a reason to want something besides what's here.
Sure. So let's at least spend 10 minutes in fantasy land. We've smashed the state. They've not recovered the fierce blows that we've made against them. Capitalism is on its heels. All the multinationals have collapsed. A new world is upon us. What do we do first?
Well, whatever we want.
Okay.
I suppose.
Okay, so now the cupboards are bare.
Right. So I think that's an important thing of where contemporary anarchism is things like Reading Desert. Mm-hmm. And we can get more into Black Seed, but I think sure. That is there has not been a lot from the post-left generally that people are talking about, but the idea, I mean, obviously we're not going to get to Fantasyland.
No, no.
If but, we were but, in Fantasyland.
But let's spend 10 minutes right. at least imagining, like, would you immediately leave the city yourself? Or would you tear up the street in front of your house to plant?
I generally don't think about these questions, but I'll indulge you.
Okay.
I mean, I wouldn't go to work tomorrow.
That's easy. For sure. That's easy.
Right. But we need to eat. This would be a great place in the Bay Area. I think it would be easier to survive.
Climate-wise, for sure.
Right. And just finding food, not dying, is nice. Like, where our tribes are from, you really, it means that we're dead.
Yes. Well, we're cool.
Basically. Yeah. I mean, right.
I mean, the one thing I would say is that I don't know what in the hell I would eat if I were going to walk out of the bay and start looking for food. Whereas at least if I made it back to Michigan, I feel like I'd have a chance at, at recognizing what's edible and what's not.
Well, I don't know. I mean, people figured it out before.
Yes, that's absolutely true.
So maybe we would have a chance, but it would mean a lot of suffering. It wouldn't just mean walking into Eden, for sure.
No, for sure.
I mean, again, the reason I like to calibrate every once in a while is on some level, like, if we're talking about an anarchism that doesn't look like a worker's utopia, let's talk about an anarchism that would look like a native utopia. And I think it's, like, as an example, and this is a question that one of these initial segments is with Klee, and, you know, most of our conversation was about colonization, and sort of it centered on the question, which isn't necessarily the question that we are concerned about, but what do you do with all the treaties? In other words, you've smashed the state, you've smashed capitalism. There's plenty of people who want to continue living where they live and don't want to think about the fact that there were people before, and what's that relationship look like? In other words, does day zero mean that everything that happened before is gone? Because that doesn't look like that's not pleasant. Some bad things have happened.
Right. I mean, to use like a pan-Indian lens, think there are a lot of people from tribes that have sort of entertained these questions of what would the utopia be, which could mean that whiteness needs to go, and probably a lot of the white people. But this is something I always come back to, is I don't think those were ever real distinctions. And also that there's a value of, I think in general, natives are not going to want to kill off all the people that are visiting, even when people
are. Even if they could.
Yeah.
I mean, that is always the funny thing about, you know, when you have a set of people who sort of are the voice of a movement that basically are totally disconnected from the people that they're representing. I mean, that's my experience of AIM, and, you know, to some extent, my family was somewhat aligned with the Bellacourts, and, you know, no one agreed with what they had to say. They were just like, sure, that's fine. And, you know, it's sort of funny to imagine, like, the kind of fantasies that came out of, I guess, that 70s nationalistic era.
Sure. So,
but what would an anarchist response look like in hindsight, you know, today?
Well, I've been thinking about the events for something I've been working on, and that there's pipeline protest that people can go to, and you can see a lot of people that will get you pumped up, and it's like a spectacular action against ATVs and militarized oil workers and their friends and everything. But it's very similar to the Wounded Knee standoff in the 70s. And that basically all of these people from AIM were from cities that came in and are like looking for a spot to have the showdown. And that the fallout from that was basically a years-long inner Lakota civil war.
You mean because of the elections and whatnot that happened afterwards?
Right. Well, yeah, that there were AIM supporters and then there were...
Council supporters.
Council supporters, yeah. But that they're all natives, right. All on two different sides, or like the stuff in the Southwest with their protests against uranium mining and things like that. Different like resources. There's a long, like decades long native radical stance against it, but there's also a lot of tribal members
who want Taco Bell,
that want jobs and want to feed their families. So it's like you could say those are not the real Indians.
Right.
The real Indians are the ones that talk about ableism and like fat positivity or whatever issues the left wants. But really a lot of that is, almost all of it is coming from white leftist allies. And I'm not really comfortable picking who the real Indians are. Right. And it seems like a lot of radicals are that it seems so natural to know who the right people are.
Well, I think, of course, one example of this is the way in which certain anarchist high-profile intellectuals use natives that agree with their position or are personal friends of theirs to argue for the validity of both that person's nativeness and the illegitimacy of other natives. But I also think that this is a place to really have a conversation about what's the difference between sort of natives as people that live in this world and what an indigenous anarchism would look like. In other words, to some extent, I want to be careful about, you know, I'm not necessarily interested in building a hyphenated kind of anarchism, but the anarchism that I want to build is so attenuated and so different than an anarchism that existed before the Spanish Civil War that, you know, for me, the purpose of having conversations about hyphenations and about different perspectives is to build and grow the position. So your thoughts?
I also don't want to just get into tribal politics that are just as boring and caustic as any other form of politics, but that I think there's something of indigenous values that says people are going to have conflicts, that you're going to be entwined with people and not everyone is going to agree with each other, and that is a strength, and that's sort of what I'm arguing for, and I feel like that can apply to people in a broader sense within anarchy.
How would you describe the ecological position of an indigenous perspective?
Well, it could mean a few things. It could mean modern natives that are influenced by biology and ecology in a hard science sense, and that they kind of use their native identity to give some gravitas to it. But something more interesting to me just means being in touch with your local area. But that is a lot different than being in touch with the earth. It means that you're subsisting, that you're taking from the land, that maybe you're clear cutting sometimes. To be wooey, people would talk about being grateful or communicating with animals in ecosystems. But I guess that isn't really my world necessarily. People from my tribe still gather wild rice, and you eat fish and use it a lot more than most people in like a small town do, but people in small towns also hunt. I think it's pretty similar. I guess I'd have to be more negative to say that those kind of things are not part of my reality, and I don't think that they connect with a lot of people anymore.
I mean, one of the problems with talking about indigeneity at all is that we're urban people. Mm-hmm. We live in a ginormous city, and
most natives do,
and absolutely the vast majority, as a matter of fact, and the ones that don't live in basically ghettoized rural environments that are hellscapes. They're not actually places trailer parks in the country are not necessarily closer to nature than where we're sitting right now, which is actually a garden of California native plants. And so in this way, you know, this conversation embeds a type of hopelessness that's hard to sort of escape or to parse out of. I mean, I think that, you know, for me, when I first started to think about these ideas, like, I knew that it was impossible, that there weren't enough people, that there wasn't, that it was impossible. So I guess in that context, let's talk about a little bit about the Black Seed Project and what we hope to accomplish, or what you hope to accomplish, at least, in that vein.
So earlier I talked about desert, and I think I was excited about Black Seed when it first came out, maybe because of nostalgia.
For GA.
For Green Anarchy, the magazine. Mm-hmm. And I think it just makes me feel a little relieved compared to a lot of the issues that people talk about in the left, in big cities, that are about who is the bad person based on whatever categories they fall into. And Green Anarchy mostly doesn't need to deal with those issues. But that something that separates Green Anarchy is maybe a slightly more pessimistic view.
In what way, do you think? In other words, GA also comes out of Earth First and out of some sort of positive environmentalism.
Well, just, I think including like the Dark Mountain Project, and that there's a thread of anti-humanism that I feel is more pronounced, but it's not necessarily a cohesive position from all of the contributors.
Let's talk about that a little bit. To what extent do you think natives would balk at the idea of being associated with or not with a humanist position? Because I think a lot of urban Indians would basically say that they're humanists.
They are. So I guess I'm saying who the real Indian is, with enough space to make myself still exist. Mm-hmm. But definitely humanism played a huge role, at least in like a proto nebulous form of how colonization happened. Yes. And like rationality as the ultimate way of being in the world, and then deciding who is fully human or not. And I'd say that including the savages as being human, maybe I feel is harsher than if people would have been left out of having souls and being a part of the fodder for conversion.
It definitely would be a clearer relationship to a world you hate if you were literally defined as being on the outside of it. And that's, of course, one of the problems that's always true in identity politics, is that a lot of identity politics is a quest for inclusion. Mm-hmm. You know, in this dominant system. There was an article today in the New York Times editorial that basically said that 2017 was the best year in human history. And the measure that it was using to describe that was literacy. Literacy is down to 15%, and extreme poverty and extreme poverty, which I think used to be as high as like 30%+, is now 10%. And that both of those, per the editorial, will probably be eliminated in the next 15 years. And, you know, on the one hand, I know that if I were living in this place and were illiterate and experiencing extreme poverty, my life would really suck. But I'm just not that convinced that there aren't tons of life ways in which literacy is irrelevant and extreme poverty can be seen from a variety of different angles. I mean, I'm sure that part of their definition has to do with the number of calories per day, but part of their definition has to probably do with, you know, shoes on your feet and electricity and, you know, other things that I don't think are necessary for health and happiness. I don't know. I sort of bring that up to sort of say that I guess part of our shared project is this idea of trying to skew the lens of how good and bad are defined in such a way that people understand that all of the things that they just assume are good are only good from a particular sort of worldview. I mean, this is, I think, one of the problems with sort of associating ourselves with Mexican indigeneity is that that border and that language gap, you know, really makes it extremely hard to parse. So for a lot of people who consider themselves to be revolutionary, they look at the Zapatistas as being basically the one true revolutionary indigenous struggle of our generation. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, they definitely like to brand themselves like that they're not only representing a specific indigenous point of view or resistance, but that they're everywhere where anyone is being harmed, that they're Zapatista in the brothels, in the factories type of thing. That is terrible to me. That does not make me feel comfortable, but what you're describing with your statistics is a great example of what humanism is. And it's a good way to talk about some of the things from Black Seed that I think are new points of view that weren't in earlier forms. That basically, if we get everything that we want, like if we have food and the bare minimum, we're not amputees. That's good. And I guess maybe that's if we want to use the word nihilism in a way, is that that's something that's attractive about nihilism, is this idea of an absolute, that it's like, even if I have a job and I have a nice bed, that is not enough. And it's sort of related to some kind of spiritual impulse that is, this is not enough for me. And having treaties and being comfortable with casino money is not, it's not my end game.
It's not enough. I mean, that actually is a topic that we haven't talked about very much, and I'm sure you're uncomfortable with it, as I normally am, but I'll at least go there a little bit right now. My understanding of a spiritual perspective decenters humans. And my humanism or anti-humanism isn't based in a Nietzschean Übermensch philosophy. It is not based on the fact that humans are stupid and should be cold or something. It's based in the idea that I believe that all the things I interact with are equally sacred, and that I do not valorize humans. I mean, especially in my life lately, humans, you know, tend to be a disappointment, and much more of a disappointment than, for instance, dogs or the mold and the grasses that exist here in the yard. And and to me, I guess I reflect on that as sort of what my daily life looks like, much more than trying to figure out what a human-centered process of solving problems is. Do you have you more or less abandoned spirituality as like a way in which you think about what your life looks like? Like, in other words, has the city cured you of it?
I'm not burning a lot of sage on the day to day. It's complicated, I think. And then there's something about not being able to separate culture from spirituality in a hard and fast way. But I feel like there is an animist influence in how I go about things. But that this is also why part of why I would bring up nihilism is that there's something about an indigeneity that admits that a genocide happened and that we're just sort of like the way Antifa wants to wear scarves and go fight in the streets. You could want this nice vision of things. And it's like, really, I grew up with certain ceremonies. There's still sweat lodges and the pipe, but it's most of it is just coming back, and it's really distorted that most things were abandoned or outlawed, but that there's still some of it left. But for me to go to like a sweat ceremony in San Francisco or something, it's not appealing.
With a bunch of strangers?
Yeah. No.
Yeah. Yeah. We've considered building a sweat lodge in the backyard. I don't know if you know that, but we actually have another backyard.
Hmm.
And it would be perfect because it's really isolated and has, you know, high fences and a really beautiful redwood tree. But you know, of course, just like anything else, it's so hard to imagine. Like, I mostly learned about sweat lodges through white people being enthusiastic about them in a way that I didn't find all that interesting or attractive, much more than it was actually a practice that my family did. Mm-hmm. Most of the practices that were left for me, you know, were much smaller. They were much more like, I think you'd call them like folk, you know, like particular hexes and charms. Mm-hmm. They were more on that level. And there was, you know, I had a grandmother who was both Catholic and Native, who was very into saints and giving the little tokens for the saints. And also would talk about bear walkers and basically about being really, really reticent to interact with other natives because she was afraid of them, basically of what they would do in the spirit. Like essentially assuming that they were all evilly inclined in the spirit realm and that she had to sort of keep her guard up for the attacks of bear walkers. You know, which is just like this totally psychotic, what do you call, like pantheon, you know?
Sure, yeah. Like, but I think...
It was like all the demons were native and all the angels
I've
were...
I've heard stories like that before. That sounds familiar.
Yeah.
But I guess like the idea of trying to start a sweat lodge, it is... I guess I'm saying we're not alonies.
Sure.
But we live here and we still exist in that any kind of learning how to feed yourself or find cosmology, we have to start from being deformed and we're probably going to embarrass ourselves. So maybe we could learn from new age people of what not to do, but it's like there's no reason not to try, but to try and talk about it with people and explain these experiments in general, it's like it's probably not a good idea. And I see this frankly,
you're actually talking about like almost the direct content of my article on this topic.
Okay, sure. Well, I want to just, you were talking about the difference between Mexicans that are indigenous. And I see this a lot in the Bay Area and especially at my time at school. It's like,
for those of you who don't know, and there's a couple of data points that sort of we assume because we know, but that are worth mentioning. One is that this is your first issue being one of the editors of Black Seed. Is that
right?
True? Yeah. But you did contribute writing to the last issue, and you also have a degree. You're in a, you're like not just a native, you're like an official native because you have a degree in it.
I feel like that makes me less authentic, but it's true. And I think I was really doing it for money, and it's kind of a troll.
Sure. Although you didn't troll that much in school itself, did you?
When I had a chance to. I mean, just things like I could give a talk and just talk about trickster body stories and make everyone uncomfortable because they're really liberals and they can't handle what a trickster does.
I mean, they have
with
the same
genitals.
They have the same problems with American sexuality that everyone else does.
Right. But I would see, especially people that are Latino, Latinx, that they would come to school and they're from like the suburbs, like from SoCal. And
from
then
the
they
LA
get to
suburbs,
school,
yeah.
Right? And then they get like a patterned shirt and wood beads and like a headband. And I'm just like, dude. And that they're all Aztecs,
yeah.
Which is just, so I'm saying I identify with that in some way to say that, like, we're all embarrassing. We're all embarrassing. It's like the Euro-pagans that are just sort of trying to find meaning, which I understand trying to find meaning, but just to be like, we don't have that shit. We have to. We have to start over.
Yeah. I mean, that's exactly my position is that, you know, while being indigenous is important, it's important because it's a way to frame the way in which we have to start over. And yes, it absolutely means that we have histories and there are stories and there are, and we definitely want to hear those stories. But by and large, we can't trust the politics of some of the people who are telling those stories. And that's hard because, you know, I would love to have more mentors and more elders that I could trust. But when it comes to this conversation, not so many.
Yeah. And I guess I'd talk a little bit about Gerald Visner because he's really the only reason I went into school. And it's funny.
You knew about him before you went in.
I found out about Visner from a footnote in a John Zerzan piece where he was like, here's this crazy postmodern Indian who he's from the Minnesota Chippewa tribe like I am, and he's from where I'm from. And basically Zerzan being like, don't read this. And I was like, fuck, I want to find out.
Oh, I didn't realize
person.
That.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
But he is totally academic, but also very interesting in these conversations that he, a large part of his project, it was originally criticizing AIM from the point of view of someone who's from the reservation, but that he's super critical of a European mono view and the way that Native American nationalism plays itself out and that he talks about landfill meditation and New Age Native spirituality, like as we're sitting in a garbage world, being mystical and about thing like giving white people Indian names in a parking lot, and all these the New York ghost dance or the San Francisco ghost dancers. I guess New York would work, sure. But it's especially in. Yeah. In the Bay Area, and I feel like when he was coming up, it would have been even harder to stomach, but that he definitely is not on board for the New Agey stuff. Admits that that is cheesy, but that there's still like things you can learn that you can, I guess, that he talks about being present. And really also I saw some of his stuff looking for Native Americans that are influenced by nihilism. And he's basically, besides you, he's one of the only people doing something like that.
Yeah. What does he call it? Does he use that term, or
he uses a lot of terms. Yeah. He likes to make up. He definitely, I would say, is guilty of a lot of postmodern tropes.
I have to admit, you know, thinking forward about sort of some stuff that we should do in the regarding Black Seed, there, I think that there are like three or four different worlds of quote unquote postmodern Indians who are actually doing some interesting shit that I think that it might be worth chasing them down and sort of seeing what their thing is. Like, there was some, when I was about to go on this last trip to interview people, there was a person who someone was really trying to get me to sit down with, but I just, the logistics didn't work, who was involved in, native futurism. We're like,
oh, sure. There's definitely a lot of cool sci-fi native writers.
Yeah. And so obviously I would love to check that out and just sort of see, you know, who is the outsider to that? What does the inside look like? And it's worth mentioning. I mean, Sherman Alexie is a fantastic representative.
He's a great children's writer.
Yeah.
Young adult writer.
Yeah. I mean, he tells orthogonal stories to what people think the expected narrative is. And he does it, I mean, you know, pretty consistently in all of his stuff. And he does sexuality in a pretty interesting way too. In a way that white culture, especially right now, would really like I can imagine there being some like call out of him.
Oh, that has definitely happened.
I mean, you've heard of this.
For sure. I mean, just because he's so overly represented, which happens. Right. But I think even just like another part of Black Seed that I liked is that there is this literary bent.
That's the Dark Mountain influence.
Sure. And I think that's great. And you could look at a lot of the, they call it the Native American Renaissance writers, like Leslie
Silko
and James Welch and all these people, like even N. Scott Mamaday, that the way they're approaching novels is to try and like undo binaries between good and bad and human nature, white native. Like that's kind of like a lot of what they were trying to do.
I mean,
and the sexuality, that was my main point, is that it would make people uncomfortable.
Yeah, very uncomfortable.
And it's inspired by, even though these are people from different tribes, it's definitely something that wouldn't make the accountability process, consent culture, or the modern trans people comfortable.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting to think how we're going to be able to thread those needles because, of course, on the one hand, we live in a North American context where, we don't necessarily want to make a large body of people our enemies just for shits and giggles.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, you know, how do you sort of oppose that liberal doctrine? And yeah, I look forward to get in that kind of content. We actually got this interesting piece of content that's really short, and I'm hoping to expand it before publication. That's essentially this young woman talking about giving birth outside the state. And that to me sort of speaks to like, yeah, like this is tense. Like she basically had to escape her world. Like she didn't register the kid and then went to the woods and like, whoa, who in the hell hears about that in the 21st century? But we'll see if it develops into a worthwhile piece. But it's really short and really like hard on its sleeve, earnest. So, I mean, obviously like the goal, you know, pushing forward is to maintain literary influences, but it's just so hard to get good ones. Like, you know, the internet has made people into shittier writers, and in radical circles, they weren't great writers before. Like, we're not flooded with great content. And you know, I mean, as you recall from the last meeting, you know, I mean, I'm very concerned that we're going to have to write half the content for the next issue, which, you know, I would like to return to a twice a year publication. So it's
right. And that would be okay. I like the stuff that this core group writes, but I think it's, and we also talked about not wanting to get pinned down to an ideology that maybe people see us as having that we don't really have a certain position we're trying to argue for. And that's also something that I liked about Green Anarchist writing before, is that it was had contradictions.
Sure.
And that
GA as a publication was incredibly eclectic.
And that is great. And that seems like a way to approach indigeneity in an abstract way. And I feel like that's getting harder to do.
Yeah, I'm not sure where I would go to think about a strong counter voice, like that would make sense in the context of Black Seed. I mean, yeah, I mean, I think we need to find one or two, and I'm not sure where to go to find them. I mean, you know, we still have a body of natives who I think will write for the publication and who will be more involved, but a lot of them are really young writers. They have almost, you know, they're very little experience, and some of them are pretty punk. Yeah, there's a pretty big punk scene that has yet to really sort of find its voice.
Well, thank you very much for this conversation. And I'm not sure we exactly got to the question, but I do think that we impressed upon a listener the set of ideas that I think we think should be important within the anarchist space. And they're pretty different than the things that have come before. Not so much focused on revolution, maybe more focused on how to live. Any last words?
No, I don't have any last words. There's no last words, Aragorn.
Really?
We just keep...
The conversation just keeps on going on.